I got your email, and that's the class.
I mean, personally, Beth, I'm looking at
I couldn't talk to Nemo whether you'd be here today or not.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Okay, let's begin. Any questions on the last class or anything on the readings or anything we've been doing? This will probably be one of the last sessions on the Romance languages. I may need a bit of time Thursday. But after that, we'll sort of look at a parallel case of dealing with English. So the next things you should be reading in the course pack are that series of articles in the course pack that deal with the history of the English language. Again, those form just general background to some of the things I want to say. As I said, the lectures themselves will not be based, you know, specifically on those readings, although I certainly will attempt to answer questions or anything specific you may have with regard to that. Okay. All right. What I wanted to
You want me to read this little thing?
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. It's just part of procedure. I'm supposed to do it. Questions about any of this information? Sure.
Are you gonna? This is gonna be transcribed, like written down, or it's gonna be played?
Right. Well, we hope to have it both available in form of transcription, like somebody can read out on a piece of paper, and also as a digitized computer
site
program, yeah, running things so people can listen to it. We have programs that can do that. Just figuring it out.
See, for someone like me who does language history, I wish they had done this 1,000 years ago so I could have recordings. Of what Spanish sounded like 1,000 years ago. It was very nice.
Other questions?
Okay. What I want to do is continue with this discussion that we've been trying to show between the interaction of history and language change. And again, as I state, we're using the Romance languages as sort of our test case because we have an abundant documentation of the situation, both of the historical development of the Romance languages, the historical background, the real-world events which occurred from the start of the Roman Empire right up to the fall of the Roman Empire, and the ultimate fate of the various provinces of the Roman Empire. And we also have an abundant corpus of linguistic documentation. So to a large extent, the Romance languages present an ideal case for studying the development of language against the background of history, or conversely, how history affects language. One of the issues that I want to particularly concentrate on today is the issue of the linguistic impact of language contact. One of the main historical themes that I've been stressing throughout the last couple of classes has been that in the linguistic history of the Roman Empire, we've had movements of peoples. We first of all have the expansion of the Romans as the Romans left Rome and over the course of several centuries expanded their territorial domain to what was to become the Roman Empire, which at its height stretched from Ireland all the way in, through the west, well, most of central, western, and eastern Europe, and through the Mediterranean basin, both the north and south shore of the Mediterranean, and beyond into Asia Minor. Other movements of peoples that are also relevant we'll see a little later when the Roman Empire falls apart, and when various ethnic groups, invade or enter, perhaps it would be the better word, there really wasn't an invasion in the strict organized military sense, but when outside groups entered the Roman Empire, this also led to the movements of peoples who came into contact with the Romans. So in both cases, with the territorial expansion of the Romans as they moved in and expanded their empire, and then with the entry into the Roman Empire of other peoples, the result of this is language contact. In other words, Latin comes into contact first with what we conveniently call the pre-Roman languages. In other words, the Romance, the various languages which were spoken in the territories which became part of the Roman Empire. As I mentioned to you, in most cases, most of these pre-Roman languages actually ended up falling into disuse. Speakers gave them up in favor of Latin, as they saw that Latin was a language, was a vehicle of a more prestigious culture, and also it was the linguistic vehicle which you had no choice but to use if you wanted to advance in society. Now, there's very little doubt from a linguistic point of view, there's very little doubt in the minds of most specialists of when languages come into contact, that there is a transfer of material between the languages. The degree and intensity of this will often depend on the relationships between the languages. whether they're languages that enjoy an equal degree of prestige or whether one language enjoys more prestige over the other. The least controversial aspect of this, as I've already mentioned to you, and I'm not going to load you up with examples, one thing to keep in mind as we go along, even when we get into some of the technical things we're going to talk about today, I really want to get across to you the big picture, the more general issues. Don't worry about the nitty-gritty of the actual linguistic details that I'm going to present. Obviously, it has to be presented with linguistic facts, but I'm more interested in you getting just the broad picture, the general principles that that are at issue here. Okay, so most scholars will agree that there will be lexical borrowing, that when languages come into contact with each other, the languages will transmit vocabulary, especially to fill gaps in the existing vocabulary. The Romance languages are full of examples of words that that scholars will attribute, let's say, to the pre-Roman languages. If you read any of the standard histories of, let's say, the French language, there'll usually be a list of words in French that are believed to be of Celtic origin, that they're words that, in other words, words that enter the local varieties of Latin spoken in Gaul due to linguistic contact with the Celts. If you read any of the standard histories of Spanish, you'll find lists of examples of words that are allegedly of pre-Roman origin that came into the spoken Latin of the Iberian Peninsula from the various languages spoken in the Iberian Peninsula at the time that the Romans arrived. Again, one of the more interesting differences between, let's say, France and Spain, and even between, let's say, Spain, France, and Italy in this regard, is that in the territory that we today call Italy, and in the territory that we today call France, all the pre-Roman languages that were spoken were eliminated. Although one might say, hey, isn't there a variety of Celtic spoken in France? That's true, there is a variety of Celtic spoken in France. The dialect of Brittany, that language called Breton. But that is not a vestige of the Celts who were there in the Iberian, in France rather, or in Gaul at the time the Romans arrived, but rather represents the result of a later historical migration of people from the British Isles to that part of France known as Brittany. Whereas in Spain, we do have the interesting case that one of the pre-Roman languages survived and is still spoken today, very much so. And I'm referring, of course, to Basque, which indeed has, in certain regions of the country, actually enjoys official status. In the Basque country, government and activities, school activities, are conducted in both Spanish, the official language of Spain, and also in Basque. What is much more controversial, which I want to discuss today, is this issue, and this is the general issue of whether non-lexical features can be transmitted from one language to another through language contact. In other words, the issue of structural change. Are there linguistic changes that can be attributed to language contact? This is a fairly controversial area, at least within the area of Romance linguistics. And to a certain extent, the answer to this question is also reflected almost what you call scholarly trends or fads. At an early period in the history of Romance linguistics as a scholarly discipline, this type of approach had a great appeal. Back around the turn of the century, when historical linguistics still was not yet, fully-fledged, sophisticated discipline, especially people who studied the history of the Romance languages would look at, let's say, a given change in the history of French or Spanish or Italian, and if this change were sort of unique, in other words, if it were a process that occurred only in one of the Romance languages and not in any of the others, they might wonder, well, gee, this is kind of strange. How would we explain it? And they often would try to attribute it to external sources, and external sources would be basically in a situation of language contact. This is what's known in the literature, and you'll find reference to this in your reading, of course, back to the substratum hypothesis. Again, this metaphor of substratum is one of those geological metaphors which pervade historical linguistics. In other words, the substratum is the levels of languages, obviously a geological metaphor. If let us say the main stratum is Latin, the substratum languages, according to this theory, are those languages that were there before Latin overlay them, okay? So they form a sort of linguistic substratum. And it was argued back then that even if these languages were falling into disuse, some of the speech habits of the speakers of these languages may have affected the way they spoke Latin. And this was a common way of trying to explain changes that were a bit out of the ordinary. I think in this case, a picture is probably worth 1,000 words. So I want to give you 3 concrete examples rather than talk about this abstractly. I'm going to present from the history of the Romance languages 3 examples of structural changes. All of them deal with sound change, by the way, that were attributed at one point by major scholars to the result of language contact. And in fact, one of them is a problem that's very specifically unique to Spanish. Another is an issue that is usually associated with French, although a parallel phenomenon does occur in a couple of other Romance varieties. And then there's a more broad-based issue as well, a phenomenon that is found in various Romance languages. So I want to look at the 3 of them as separate issues and then try to relate it to this more general issue of how historical linguists discuss the important question as to whether external forces can play a role in structural change. Because linguistics, like any other intellectual discipline, has its fad. At one point, this type of explanation was very much in vogue, and scholars loved it. It was almost de rigueur. In fact, the most attempts at explanations were of this type, of this trying to explain changes through external forces. Whereas later, and this is a trend that still dominates, most structural change is looked upon as being due to internal structural factors, that language contact or real world has nothing to do with it, and that these changes can all be explained internally, that there are structural motivations that you can try to analyze in structure, one can try to find the explanation for the change within the inherent, within the structure of language. And today, even it's interesting intellectually, not only is this sort of this chronological difference between the two approaches, but there's even almost a cultural difference. Substratum explanations still enjoy a certain degree of popularity, although I will admit today, much less so than, let's say, 20 or 30 years ago when I was a graduate student. But this type of explanation enjoyed a certain degree of popularity, especially in European scholarship, whereas American scholarship was much more skeptical to this sort of approach. Whereas Europeans had a more cultural approach to language change, American scholarship, especially that field, that approach to linguistics known as structuralism, which, by the way, has its origins in Europe and not in America as such. American structuralism basically looked at language as a mechanism, as a structure, and changes were to be explained within the framework of that structure without taking into consideration external features. So this is a point is much debated. But anyway, let's look at the specific changes. Now here I'll have to give you some linguistic data first of all. Let's start with the change that's quite typical in Spanish and look at the various types of approaches to it. There is a change in the history of Spanish whereby there are a number of lexical items that in Latin began with a sound that is represented in the Latin alphabet by what we call the letter F. And therefore it is assumed, and probably rightly so, but I'm going to make a slight modification of this as we go along. It's assumed that letter F in Latin, on the basis of the Romance languages today, that the F represented basically the same sound as it does today in the Romance languages and even in English, that it is what is known, if you have some phonetics, as the voiceless labiodental fricative. Okay, so it's a voiceless labiodental fricative. Again, for those of you who haven't had any linguistics, don't worry about this. If you've had linguistics, you know what I mean. Labiodental refers to the point of articulation, that is, the sound is made by the teeth touching the lips, in this case, the upper teeth touching the lower lips. Voiceless means the vocal cords do not vibrate, so there's no audible vibration. And fricative describes how the air actually passes through the point of contact, that it actually rubs, there's friction. And so the sound is a th sound, okay, represented by the letter F. Now, there are a number of words, not every one of these words. I'm not going to go into the issue here of the regularity of sound change and why some items of structure show this change and others don't. All right, although it's an interesting question, and maybe one we could discuss within the framework of this class, it probably is not relevant to the relationship of, let's say, language and history. Anyway,
There are a number of words. I'm only going to give you three or four examples, but take my word for it, there are dozens more I can give. But let's just use three or four as a representative sample of the entire thing. So you have this Latin word. This is the verb to make or to do in Latin. Facere. If you can't read my writing and want me to spell any of these out for you, just come hesitate to ask. Let's take this Latin word, the Latin word filius. This is the word for son, S-O-N, the male child. All right, the word for son. This word here, F-O-L-I-A, folia, is the Latin word for a leaf, like a leaf on a tree. And this verb here, fabulati, now right in its classical form, although this is not the immediate form that would underlie the Romance form that I want to talk about, this is a verb that meant to speak or to talk. All right, originally to tell fables, to tell tales, etc. Okay, we have these four. Now, in Spanish, and especially when I say in Spanish, in only one of the varieties of Hispano-Romance, actually, the variety that became the standard of what we call it Spanish, but strictly speaking, I really want to be strict about this. I really shouldn't say in Spanish, but I should really say in Castilian, i.e. in that particular variety of Hispano-Romance known as Castilian, because there did exist other varieties. Why Castilian became the norm as a national language is actually an issue perhaps worth mentioning within this broader framework, but not today, maybe next class. I'm going to write the modern forms instead of the medieval forms. This word facere gives you in Latin, Spanish, and again, many of you will know these words, gives you this verb, hacer, with an H, spelled with an H, which today is not pronounced. Today the H is simply an orthographic relic. But for those who have studied Spanish, the initial H in Spanish is completely silent. It has no phonetic value whatsoever. It's a holdover, it's a relic, it's an outage, it's there to cause confusion and make your life miserable. All right? The word for son is this word, pronounced hijo, hijo. The word for leaf is this word, H-O-J-A, pronounced hoja, hoja. And the verb to speak or to talk is this verb, spelled H-A-B-L-A-R, hablar. Now, this H, as I said today, is not pronounced, but we do know it here. You just have to take my word for it. I wouldn't lie to you too often. The H in medieval Spanish was pronounced. I mean, there is a historical reason for that H being there in these particular cases, all right? So we do know in medieval Spanish, we do have evidence to prove it, including one of the first descriptions of the Spanish language that goes back to the Middle Ages, that this H was pronounced. And so at one point, these words, this H was sort of an aspirated type sound. Okay, it was an aspirated, a voiceless aspirate, of like an English H in those words where you actually pronounce the H, okay? So this would have been pronounced at some point in its history, something like hatzer, hijo in Old Spanish, hijo in modern Spanish, hoja in Old Spanish, the letter J underwent a change in Spanish, at least its value. It's used to represent a J type sound, it's now a H type sound. I mentioned that just for those who are interested in it. It's totally irrelevant to what I'm talking about.
Is it still in some parts of the world a J sound?
No. There is a J sound in some varieties of Spanish, like the Argentine Spanish,
yeah.
But that J sound is a modern development. Relatively modern development, which affects the pronunciation of what's written with these two letters, the letter Y or that double L, which no longer is, by the way, a separate letter of the Spanish alphabet. The Spanish Royal Academy has demoted this as being a separate letter of the alphabet to just, and no longer has its own separate entry in the dictionary, but from here on in, the word with double L will go in the appropriate place under the letter L instead of being a separate letter. That's around. But no, what you're thinking of is a phenomenon that you hear very often in Argentinian Spanish especially, but it's spreading, by the way, because the year I lived in southern Spain a few years ago, I was noticing quite frequently in the local speech of Seville and of the province of Andalusia, and when I commented on it to a colleague of mine who's a linguist and interested in current dialectological changes, he said, oh yes, this is a phenomenon that's spreading quite rapidly. And actually, it could spread throughout the whole Spanish world, because from the point of view of natural phonetic processes, it's actually a very natural process. But what you're referring to is the pronunciation of this word as llamar. In other words, someone saying, me llamo Juan. Okay? Me llamo Juan. O vivo en la calle, so-and-so. Okay? Okay. So the sound is coming back, but this and this have absolutely no relationship to each other whatsoever. All right.
Now, if you take a look at this, so what it seems we have in Spanish, what appears to be a sound change, by which, to put it in these simple terms, the way the old-fashioned books used to present this would just simply be in terms of, they use the letters, and they just basically say that there was this change. This little dash after the F and the H indicates that it's in word initial position only, which is true. This sound is, this change is limited only to the plus sound when found in word initial position, usually before another vowel, but again, we don't have to worry about the flying forms of it. But basically what you have linguistically is you have a change in terms of features. You have a change from a from what was a voiceless labiodental fricative to a voiceless, perhaps pharyngeal, aspirate. And basically what's even more, perhaps more striking with regard to this change from the point of view of phonetics is that the labiodental fricative is pronounced in the front of the mouth, whereas the pharyngeal aspirate, by being pharyngeal just by definition, is pronounced way at the back. In other words, the point of articulation of this change has moved from the front to the back. And that's a fairly large leap in physiological terms. All right? Now, what is interesting, what caught the attention of early pioneer scholars was two things with regard to this change. One was the very nature of the change, a change going from f to h. And the second was that within the framework of the Romance languages, and at the time, most scholars, you know, around the turn of the century, when they studied the Romance languages, they were familiar mainly with the literary varieties. People were just getting started in studying lesser regional varieties, so what we colloquially and popularly and inaccurately call dialects. But basically, you have what struck everybody's attention was that this change seemed to be limited to Castilian only. That in other varieties of Romance, this change did not occur. And let me just give you two quick examples. Let's take right next door to Spanish, we have Portuguese. These four words also survive in Portuguese, but the Portuguese forms have been, since the Middle Ages, on the following. The verb to do or to make is F-A-Z-E-R, fazer. The word for a son, male child, well, that's for those of you sitting up there, it's bad to see what's wrong here, really. Sorry. Okay, the Portuguese forms would be for the verb to do or to make is fazer, F-A-C-E-R, fazer. The word for son is spelled F-I-L-H-O, pronounced filho. The word for leaf is folha, F-O-L-H-A. This L-H is a Portuguese orthography for a y sound. And the verb to speak is falar. In French, the verb to do or to make is the verb faire. The word for a son, that is a male child, is le fils. The word for leaf is feuille. And as far as the verb to speak is concerned, we can leave this out because we don't have a cognate. As it happens in the Latin of Gaul, a different verb was used, the verb parabolare. Was the verb that meant to speak, or the one that dominated, was the one that evolved into the French word parler. In other words, this Latin fabulari, it was typical of the Latin of the Iberian Peninsula because it survives in both Spanish and Portuguese, but apparently it was not the lexical choice in the Latin of the Roman province of Gaul, where the different verb parabolari dominated and became the verb parler, so we'll leave that one out. And let's even just go with the Italian. The verb to do or to make is facere or fare, depending upon how you want to do things. The word for a son is figlio, F-I-G-L-I-O. The word for a leaf is a foglia. And again, this word to speak, it's a different word, parlare. We don't need that. But the point is that just using these particular varieties of Romance is that this change fataha appears to occur only in Spanish. It doesn't occur in any of the other Romance languages. It seems to be limited to Spanish. And it's also, in linguistic terms, it is a strange change. Now, that's not a very scientific way to describe anything, by the way, to say that's strange. Or to even use a worse description, unnatural. linguists have talked about changes that are more natural than others. That's a statistical term, and it's nothing to do with human physiology or natural or unnatural speech acts. If a human can do it, it's natural. So futtacha, since it is possible to go from futtacha, it is an articulatory possibility. It is not an unnatural speech act. It may not be a statistically very common or frequent change in the totality of changes that are observable in the world's languages, but that is irrelevant in our considerations. But statistically, it's not all that common. And so within the framework of the Romance languages, it really stood out. Why would Spanish go this route? And the thing here I want to emphasize is not only was it just Spanish, but it was that one specific variety called Castilian, which was basically the variety. I want to avoid the use of the word dialect. It was the variety that, for non-linguistic reasons, became the model for the standard language. If the political situation in medieval Spain had been different than what it ended up being, it is conceivable that another variety of Romance would have become the standard, the national standard, and we might not even be discussing this issue. Because what is interesting is within the framework, if we limit ourselves just to the varieties of Romance spoken in what is today Spain, the neighboring varieties, they have, let's say in the middle you have Castilian, to the west you have Leonese, and to the east you have Aragonese. In Aragonese and Leonese, this change of foot to foot did not occur either. Leonese and Aragonese behaved exactly as did Portuguese or as did French or Italian. In other words, the change did not occur. The foot stayed in, remained intact. So one gets the impression that we have here a very strange change. So scholars went ahead, well, how do we explain?
What are you saying?
Foot to foot?
And so you're saying the F is changing into...
Yeah, well, what occurred is, what happened is that in Castilian, and only in Castilian, what was a foot in Latin, or what is believed to have been a foot in Latin, because I'm going to have to sort of nuance a little later something I'm saying, but what traditionally was believed to be an F sound in Latin, a F sound, in other words, a later dental fricative, as Castilian evolved, that F became a H, all right? Whereas in all the other varieties of Romance, that didn't occur.
How do you know that that's the case, or that maybe they were using a letter which we use for something else to represent the labiodental?
Because we have the living evidence of all the other Romance languages. Moreover, the other point is, because here I'm giving you just limited data, there are lots of exceptions to this rule. Okay, there are a fair number of exceptions. Okay? I'm afraid to really answer your question thoroughly, I would have to go off on such a tangent, it would lead us much too far afield. Your question is perfectly legitimate, and I don't want to give you the impression I'm just trying to deke it, or duck it, rather. So if you want to discuss it with me further, I'd be more than happy, but I don't want to take up class time on that, okay? So I'll ask you to make an act of faith and believe me. All right? Okay, so we have the situation. Scholars wondered, well, what could have caused this strange thing to happen? And they came up with an external explanation. Because it had been noticed by some scholars that the Basque language, in Spanish, there's reason to believe that at older stages of Basque, and here again I won't be able to explain all the details, it was the Basque, apparently using the comparative method of reconstructing Basque. Remember, we discussed the comparative method in the first half of this course, and we discussed the general principles of it. We didn't go into a detailed introduction as to what it is. That's would be done in a course that was strictly an introduction to historical linguistics and not language and history. But when scholars have attempted to reconstruct the earlier stages of Basque based upon what we know about the various varieties today that we subsume under that one label, Basque, remember, Basque as a language is only attested from the 16th century onward. We know it's got a very long history, but its written history is comparatively short. Its spoken history is very long. There is good reason to believe that Basque did not have originally in its phonemic inventory the fuss sound. In other words, Basque lacked in its phonemic inventory a voiceless labiodental fricative. Let us assume that to be the case. It is a reasonable statement to make. Not every language in the world has all the same sounds. And it is very possible to have languages in which you do not have the voiceless labiodental fricative that we represent in this, using the Roman alphabet with this letter that we call F. So let us assume that Basque did not have the sound. According to the hypothesis that was uttered at the time, And the leading proponent of this hypothesis was one of Spain's great scholars. And you also have to remember in the history of scholarship, there are lots of extraneous things that affect the way people think. And in Spain, in the 1920s and 1930s, this was a country in an era in which authority ruled. First of all, you did have a very authoritarian central government. And authority was not questioned, whether it was the authority of the great teacher, or whether it was the authority of the central government, or whether it was the authority of the church. It was a society with very different attitudes and outlooks than what we're used to today. And this hypothesis gained a great deal of currency and really held and was really accepted for quite a long time by Spanish scholars, despite some serious objections raised by non-Spanish scholars, simply because of the authority and the intellectual prestige of the scholar who came up with this hypothesis. His hypothesis was the following. Speakers of Basque did not have an F. Now let's assume that to be true, that in the time of the contact between Latin and Basque, because he does take this problem back to the time of the Roman Empire, in other words, this would be a very old phenomenon, that Latin came into contact with Basque, which is true, again, that's historically verifiable, and the Basques actually offered a rather serious degree of resistance to Romanization, of all the areas of the Iberian Peninsula that most successfully resisted the Romans, the Basques held out the longest. And one could even argue, as I've said before, that the Basques basically held up, even if when the Romans said, finally, we have triumph, we now control all of the Iberian Peninsula, the Basques said, well, believe that if you want. But they really didn't submit to Roman rule. It's actually interesting. The Basques were Latinized and Romanized, not by the force of Roman arms, but as a result of Christianization. When Christianity caught on in Spain and began to spread in Spain in the 34th century, it was Christianity that played a major role in the linguistic Latinization of the Basques. But be that as it may, you have a language contact situation. You have speakers of Latin who are in, let's say, the socially prestigious situation, so we could call Latin, let's say, the upper language or the high language, and Basque is the lower language. You're going to have a situation of language contact, you're going to have a situation of speakers of Basque trying to learn Latin. The hypothesis is the following. Since speakers of Basque do not have a foot in their system, well, what happens, in fact, let me ask you this, because you all have this experience. You've all tried, all of you, I'm sure, have been in the position of having to learn at least one foreign language. And in many of the languages that you study as a foreign language, the target language, the language you're learning, will contain sounds that are not part of the language that you speak natively. For example, two of the hardest sounds for students who are native speakers of English, who are trying to learn Spanish, are the sound represented by the letter J today, the so-called Jota, the H sound of Spanish, as in the name Juan, and also, perhaps even harder, is the sound represented in the standard writing of Spanish by the orthographic double R, the alveolar trill, as in perro. It's not or anything like that. It's and students of English, if you don't have trilled R's in English, find the sound hard to learn. And what often happens? Obviously the situation when many of you have tried to learn a foreign language, you've learned in a sort of the artificial classroom setting, which is a sort of a controlled atmosphere. But what happens if, for example, you are, let us say, a native speaker of English, spirited off at a young age to a Spanish-speaking country, and you are just basically dropped in the middle of a village or whatever and told to learn, you've got to learn the language, not in the classroom, but on your own. When you start out, what is the normal reaction? Normally, what do you do with sounds that are foreign to your language? What would be the most logical thing you would try to do as you're trying to imitate the sounds of the foreign language when you come across a sound that your native system does not have?
You use something else that your native system does have that's similar.
Exactly. You usually go, until you actually start to master the language, the usual first reaction is to use a sound in your language that is somewhat similar. In other words, shares some, not all obviously, but shares some of the phonetic features associated with the sound that you're associated with this strange sound. Okay, so of course, obviously when the Basques were learning Latin in the days of the Roman Empire, the Romans did not have the goodness to organize schools and have Latin 101, followed by Latin 102, etc. If, in other words, the Basques who were learning Latin were learning it, in the marketplace or on the streets or in the fields. Probably the best way to learn language, but probably not the best way to teach elegant grammar or elegant pronunciation. So according to the theory of Menéndez Pelayo, the Basques didn't have a F sound, but rather that the Basques
did have, and this again can be documented on the basis of our reconstructions of Bass, but Bass certainly did have an H-type sound. Now, one might ask, what in common is there between the phonetic features of a F and the phonetic features of a H? What do they have in common? Is this even a reasonable linguistic hypothesis? In other words, we see, according to Menéndez-Pidal's hypothesis, by the way, Menéndez-Pidal is the name of that great Spanish scholar, don't worry about who it is. His hypothesis was that a Basque trying to pronounce facades, since the Basque didn't have a F in his or her linguistic system, they would have tried to approximate to the nearest sound, and according to Menéndez-Pidal, that sound must have been a hook. Now, he made that decision probably on the basis of what we do know. This is almost one of those cases of perhaps your mind is, you know, your analysis is prejudiced by the known facts. In other words, since we know that it ended up with an aspirated hook type sound in the Spanish, that Menéndez-Pidal would have argued, well, the hook must have been the closest sound that the Basques had in their system to a Spanish hook, or to a Latin hook, all right? Actually, whether I use the term Latin or Spanish to a large extent, this becomes almost irrelevant because that's just a continuum, just a change of labels, but really it's the same linguistic reality. It's just that for a certain chronological period we call it Latin, and after a certain chronological period we arbitrarily, from our 20th century perspective, say, oh no, this is no longer Latin, this is now Spanish. But it's in language developments like this, our uninterrupted continuum. Sometimes the labels change, Latin becomes Spanish, Latin becomes French. Sometimes the labels never change. We use the word English to refer to the language of Beowulf and the language of Chaucer and the language of today, yet clearly linguistically they are not the same. Right. So, according to Menéndez-Pidal, a Basque speaker trying to say facade wouldn't have said facade, but would have said something like hakade or whatever, would have pronounced as fuzaka, would have said something like helios instead of helios. And that this affected the way Basques learned Latin, and then this trait spread into other speakers, and thus became the local norm of pronunciation up there, and that's how it evolved. That's what the hypothesis says in a nutshell. In other words, he is arguing that this particular strange sound change, the passage from foot to a foot, is due to a non-linguistic circumstance. The non-linguistic circumstance being the arrival of the Romans and the attempt by the Basques to adapt to their language this sound that didn't exist in their language. That, now, I've highly simplified this particular problem, but again, I just want to try to get across a general issue that we're interested in, is whether external factors can play a role in motivating a structural change of this sort. Now, let's look at some of the criticisms of this particular change. Menéndez-Pidal argued that the F was replaced by a H because they are structurally similar. However, he also was aware of one other fact, which he didn't pass over, he didn't cheat, and just ignore this, but he came to a strange conclusion. Menéndez-Pidal noticed that in the Basque language, not in Spanish now, we're talking about Basque. Remember, this change that we're dealing with here is an attempt to understand how the Basques attempted to speak Spanish, or to speak Latin, which was to become Spanish, okay? Remember, this change deals with Spanish, not with Basque. We're not trying to say that Basque changed first to first, because Basque didn't have a foot. All right? It's when the speakers of Basque were trying to learn Latin that they made this change, and they pronounced their Latin. It's kind of funny that they ended up saying hakere and helios and holia and habulare, and that's led to the Spanish forms of issue. All right? However, Menéndez-Pidal noted a fact which he didn't do, but he didn't make the connection. He noted that in the Basque language, many Latin words entered, because again, nobody denies the presence of Basque words in the history of Spanish, and conversely, despite the fact that the Basques fiercely resisted Roman force of arms, as I said, the Basques did adapt Latin as a language, especially for religious purposes, starting around the 3rd and 4th centuries. And the Basques, by the way, have been some in the history of Spain, if I may just go off on a tangent, the Basques have been in Spanish history and in Spanish religious history some of the most fervent Catholics. I mean, one of the world's great religious orders was founded by a Spanish Basque in an effort to fight the Protestant hordes in the 16th century. And to which religious order am I referring, and to which famous Spanish Basque? The Jesuits, and the famous Spanish Basque being Ignatius of Loyola.
Okay, all those universities that are named Loyola in this country, you ever wonder why they're all Jesuit schools? They're named after St. Ignatius of Loyola, who was a famous Basque priest who founded the order called the Society of Jesus, which is more popularly known as the Jesuits, etc. Anyway, when speakers of lots of Latin words enter the Basque language, in other words, the lexicon of Basque is full of words whose historical origins are not part of the native stock of Basque, but rather represent words borrowed from Latin. And the one thing that was noticed is that the overwhelming majority of these Latin words that had F in them, when they were born into Basque, they weren't born into Basque with an initial H type sound, but rather they were borrowed into Basque either with a P or a B. Okay? So to just give you one example that comes to mind right off the top of my head, the Latin word festa came, I forget the exact Basque word, but it starts with a P. It doesn't start with an H. So although Menéndez Pidal is claiming that when the Basques tried to learn Latin, or you know the varieties of Latin that were going to evolve into Castilian, when the Basques tried to learn Latin, they took the Latin F and turned it into a H type sound. When the Basques adapted Latin words with a F, they didn't have the F, they adapted it not with a H, but with a P or a B. Now, linguistically, which do you think, which actually, again, if you've had phonetics, you should be able to answer this question through a bit of common sense, does not require a highly sophisticated knowledge of phonetics or phonology. In terms of phonetic proximity, with terms of features, which is closer to a F? P, or H. We can take P, B as a unit, because after all, they, except for the voicing and voicelessness, P and B are identical as far as phonetic features go. The only thing that distinguishes them is the voicelessness of the P, in other words, the vocal cords do not vibrate, versus the voice nature of the versus the voice nature of the B. So leaving that aside, in terms of phonetics, which actually is closer to a F, a H, or a P, B? And justify your answer, by the way.
P,
B. How many agree with that? Any disagreements with that? Fine, is quite correct. Now, why would you say it's closer? Yeah.
Labial.
Right. They all, the P, the B, and the F, all share the feature of labial or labiality. In other words, all of them involve in some way in their articulation the lips. All right, the lips are the lips come into play. So, therefore, it would almost seem more logical that if you're a speaker of Basque trying to learn Latin, that if you're going to adapt, and you can't pronounce the F because you don't have it, and you, instead of making the effort to learn it, and of course, that's one of the alternatives, is just to learn the new sound. After all, for those of you who have learned Spanish as native speakers of English, you have learned, to, with varying degrees of success perhaps, to pronounce the sounds of, that are the Jota and the trilled R today. Or if you're learning, if you're a native speaker of English and you're learning to speak Arabic, you've got to learn to do all sorts of uvular and pharyngeal sounds that don't exist in the English language, but you learn to do it. And the fact that you're young enough, you will learn this without any effort and just pick it up as you go along. So one would expect that if Basques, when learning Latin, were going to substitute the F with something, they were going to substitute it with an H, and they were going to substitute it with a P or a B. So that's one of the main objections or problems with this structural, with this explanation, is that why would they have done it with a B? Shouldn't they have done it with a P or a B? Yes, Brett.
Refresh my knowledge of phonetics here. Is it always or most usually the case that when you're talking about something being close to another one, your emphasis is on closeness or relatedness in terms of proximity, or does it ever have to do with both of them having the same production feature?
It's the features. No, when you mean proximity, are you talking about physical proximity?
Yes.
No, it's versus features.
Versus both, like the H and the F being in fricatives?
Well, the H and the F actually, they're not, I mean, strictly speaking, the F and the H is actually an aspirate, it's really not a fricative. Whereas,
well, I mean, having more fricative like.
Well, this presents a general and much and somewhat controversial issue of which are the most dominant features. Okay, you know, the P and the B the pushers with the fur, the features of voicelessness and of labiality, and also of physical proximity. All right, because again, the physical proximity is not unimportant, because the one thing, again, the thing that stands out in this change and makes it sort of strange in quotation marks is the fact that you're going from a sound here that's labial, i.e. involving articulators that are in the front of the articulatory apparatus, to a huh, which is articulated almost as far back as you can go in the articulatory apparatus. In other words, you're traversing the whole gamut, and even leads to the whole problem of intermediate stages, or whether it was just basically a leap from the front to the back. Okay, so this is again the one of the main objections that was raised to the substratum hypothesis, is that if we're due to Basque influence, and the Basques couldn't pronounce it, given the fact that Basques, when they adapted Latin words into the Basque language, they adapted them fairly almost consistently with the puh and buh, never with an h. This is important, all right? Whereas this change involves the puh to the huh. So again, that has been the main reason that has been challenged. All right. In other words, scholars have argued that it was quite unlikely. Moreover, and this presents the other problem of language learning, is that you could argue that the first generation, if you have a situation, let's say a Basque Latin language contact, the first generation of speakers obviously will make mistakes. It's generally been shown that the older you are, the harder it is to learn a foreign language. And also, unless you're gifted and have a good ear, the thing that many people don't get down right or never master totally is the pronunciation of the foreign language. In other words, one could maybe develop a tremendous vocabulary, have elegant grammar, know all the even the stylistic tricks, and perhaps write as well, if not better, have a wide vocabulary, but yet speak sort of with a foreign accent. Like, I will admit this in my own case. Although I'm considered in Spain to be a fluent speaker of Spanish, and many Spaniards have commented to me both on the breadth of my vocabulary and my mastery of the syntax of Spanish, both spoken and written, nevertheless, whenever I open my mouth, I give myself away as a foreigner, because I just have a tin ear, and there are certain features of pronunciation that I can, especially intonation patterns, that I just cannot imitate, and I've given up even trying to imitate them. And so I would never, the CIA could never infiltrate me into Spain and try to give me a false ID and pass me off as a native Spaniard, because as soon as I open my mouth, the word Yank or foreigner or North American is written all over me. Okay, it's obvious I'm not a native speaker. Although I may have native fluency, I am not a native speaker. There is a difference. Okay? Well, the same in language learning. However, the next generations, see, although let us say, for example, if I had gone off to Spain as a young man and despite my accent, if I had, lived in Spain, married a Spanish woman, and had children whose first and only language may have been Spanish, they would not make the native speaker mistakes that I make. In other words, these mistakes are not, transmitted in the genes, so to speak. The next generations would learn the language natively, and therefore would adapt the phonetics of the language. So that's some of the objections that are made to this hypothesis. As I said, I'm not really interested in discussing here the merits or the intrinsic merits of the hypothesis, but more or less to illustrate a type of linguistic problem that arises, whether a thing like this can be explained in terms of external factors or in terms of internal factors. The external explanation that has been given for this sound change has been the language contact between Basques and speakers of Latin. Why did the linguists want to approach it this way? The main reason at the outset was because this change seemed to be strange. In other words, it didn't occur in any other Romance languages. Linguists took the idea, well, this is weird. What factor is there in the history of Spanish that we cannot find in the history of French or Portuguese or Italian? And of course, the Basques are a wonderful answer. There are Basques in France, yeah, but not up in Paris where standard French was formed. And as it happens, because I've slightly cheated on giving you the data, the Romance dialect that's spoken on the French side of the Pyrenees, where the Basques hang out a great deal, but in other words, the French Basque country, is a Romance variety called Gascon. And Gascon also has this change of F to H. In other words, it actually occurs on both sides of the linguistic border. All right?
So the change seemed to be limited to varieties of language, to at least on the Romance side, to varieties that were in contact with Basque. It doesn't occur in standard French, it doesn't occur in standard Portuguese, it doesn't occur in standard Italian, but it occurs in Spanish. And also the other historical fact that we know is, although today we say, oh, standard Spanish, but that's a speech in Madrid or Toledo in the center, that's true. But historically, and this is a point I may actually come to in one of my other classes in dealing with Spanish, historically, the dialect Castilian that became the basis for the national language has its origins way up in the north, and then moved south as a result of a non-linguistic fact, movements of peoples involved in this process, which I'll talk about maybe next class, called the Spanish Reconquest. But Castilian historical origins are up in the far northern and central part of Spain, in that area which we know, where even today Basque is still spoken, and which we know from medieval history, in which Basque was a very live, and very much used language in the Middle Ages at the time that Castilian was evolving. Okay, so there is that, the historical facts are there. The question is, does one lead to the other? So the external explanation is due to Basques. Linguists who have rejected that have tried to come up with various internal structural explanations, which I really don't think it's worthwhile going into in the framework of this class. Let me just mention one. The one that I happen to think is maybe right. And this goes back to something actually Brett brought up. The letter F may have represented two different sounds in Latin. There may have been sort of an upper class and a lower class pronunciation. The upper class pronunciation is the one that we consider to be the standard F pronunciation today, in other words, the labiodental fricative, the foot type sound. Which therefore, and so you have the features of labiality. Another pronunciation of the F, though, or another variety that is documented, actually, in certain languages of the world, including some varieties of Spanish, is that what is written with the letter F in standard orthography is actually not a F sound, but actually it's a type sound. It's a voiceless bilabial fricative. In other words, there's no contact between the teeth and the lips, so it's not a labiodental, but rather it's a bilabial, but the lips don't come together, and so the air coming out rubs against the upper and lower lips, and you get a fricative sound. Some people have claimed that was sort of a lower class pronunciation of Latin, that the upper class people who spoke elegantly, who spoke properly, in quotation marks, pronounced the letter F as a th sound, whereas speakers who were of the least educated ilk pronounced it as more of a type sound. And we do know one thing historically, and this for which we do have historical evidence. The Romans who actually came to the northern part of the Iberian Peninsula were basically a less educated, less cultured Roman than the Romans who settled in the south of Spain. There was this interesting sociological division in the Roman colonization of the Iberian Peninsula. The more educated upper class types had the intelligence to go to the south where it's nice and warm in the winter and settle along, those nice resort areas along what today is called the Sun Coast, the coast of Del Sol in Spain. Whereas we do know that many of the Romans who settled the northern part of Spain were actually fairly uneducated soldiers and miners. One of the reasons the Romans actually wanted northern Spain was for the silver mines. There's been mining operations going on up there since the time of the Romans. The Romans discovered the silver mines up in the north and exploited them heavily for the Roman economy. And so it's been argued that there was the spoken Latin of the north was of a less cultured variety than the spoken Latin of the south. This is hypothesis, because obviously with our written text that we have preserved, you can't tell the difference, because spelling is spelling. In other words, a Roman would spell the word facere, this word facere, regardless of whether he pronounced it facere with a labiodental f, or whether he pronounced it something like, perhaps, pocketed with a bilabial act. Alright? And pardon?
It looks painful.
It looks painful because I'm doing it on match. Because again, the languages like English does not have a bilabial fricative. But there are varieties of Spanish, for example, that have a bilabial fricative there. where you say something like la fiebre instead of la fiebre for fever. Or el fuego for fire, el fuego rather than fuego. Okay? And so some people have claimed that the starting point is just an internal structural change motivated by the fact that the F was bilabial, was a bilabial fricative, not a labiodental fricative. Again, we need not go into the intrinsic linguistic arguments. The point I want to make is here there are two different explanations, one external and one internal. All right, and that's the point I actually want to try to get across. All right? Any questions on that particular example?
You said the internal was the upper lower class?
Yeah, well, that's, the internal actually would be the phonetic nature of the F, yes. Yeah. Not the fact that the class distinction is actually an external feature. But the fact is that internally, then you would have, the starting point would have been this bilingual frequency. By the way, that solution also presents a number of problems as well. I'm not necessarily advocating it, because you still have the interesting phenomenon that neither hypothesis explains, is how you get from a front sound to a back sound. Why does it go from a ch to a ch? One thing, and here this would be more of interest, but we're both interested in more general phenomena of linguistic change. It's interesting, but that in the history of Spanish, there are a number of changes that are unrelated to each other, probably. No likelihood they're unrelated, but they do have the one thing in common. They represent a switch from sounds that were pronounced in the front of the mouth toward the back of the mouth. In other words, that in the history of the Spanish language, there are a number of some changes unrelated to each other. Okay, this is important. But when you look at them separately and then try to put it all together, you might get the idea, does this indicate some sort of tendency? And the tendency is from going from, let's say, you know, put in linguistic terms, from plus front to either you want to state it either minus front or plus back, depending how you want to handle, you know, binary features. For example, you have today there's a change going on in the history of Spanish. Probably the most noticeable change that's going on today in the history of the Spanish language, to which probably is an internal change without any doubt, but it's going on all over the Spanish-speaking world, and some of you may have even experienced this, especially after you, because one of the first things, first of all, let me ask you this, how many of you have been to a Spanish-speaking country? Okay, where were you?
Spain.
What part of Spain?
Madrid.
Yeah, you've been south of Madrid. Oh, that doesn't help, because this is, and Madrid doesn't do this at all, but the south does. How many, anybody here been to the south of Spain? Or been in the Caribbean? Or at least familiar even by listening to the radio or television, let's say with Cuban Spanish or Puerto Rican Spanish.
They don't use all the letters.
That's a very unlinguistic way of putting it. You're right. That's a very unlinguistic way of putting it. They don't use they delete many sounds that happen to be still there in the standard spelling. But no, let's not confuse letters and sounds, please. That's something, I know it's a habit that even traditional historical linguists used to make. When historical linguistics was beginning as a scholarly discipline, people used the word, they didn't talk about change of sounds, they talked about change of letters. And then most of the writing, which was in German, they actually used the German word Buchstabe, which doesn't mean sound, but which means letter of the alphabet. But one of the ongoing changes in Spanish is a tendency to aspirate what is written as the letter S. So, for example, if you ask someone in Havana, or Seville, or in Puerto Rico, or anywhere along most of the coastal areas of Latin America, what is written in any variety of Spanish, for us to say it's 2 o'clock, whereas in Madrid, it would be son las dos, with a sort of apodal S, but the S is very clearly pronounced with a rather high degree of sibilancy. In Mexico City, these S's are pronounced quite strongly and very noticeable, son las dos. But if you ask this question at 2 o'clock, of course, in Havana, or in Seville, or in San Juan, Puerto Rico, or even in cities like Santiago de Chile, the odds are that the answer you will get will be son las dos. In other words, I'll transcribe it rather than spell orthography, you would have, instead of these S's, you have these aspirated sounds, that the S is becoming a F in many varieties of Spanish today. That the S, not all S's, by the way, it's conditioned. At the end of a syllable, all right, syllable final su is becoming a h in many varieties of Spanish. And in some varieties, in fact, it's the educated culture norm. It's something you'll never be taught in Spanish 101, et cetera, and if you did, you'll be corrected. But in certain areas, like in Havana or in Santo Domingo, for example, it's a norm. All the educated people do it all the time. Yes?
Is that even true on verbetics, like quanta?
Pardon?
Like quanta as opposed to quantas?
Yes, well, it affects verbatim, it affects plural marking, it affects agreements. No, it's got very serious consequences in Spanish.
So it changes all the verbs.
Yes,
so
it does.
Conjugation of the euphony.
It certainly does. Although it doesn't change the orthography, you see, but it does. But orthography is secondary. So people speak, they don't write. But obviously, they don't care. For example, with the verb, you're perfectly right. Although many Spaniards today obviously any educated Spaniard writes like this and distinguishes between these two forms. Tú hablas versus usted habla. Nevertheless, in many Spaniards, these two are pronounced almost identically. In some cases, you have the H type sound here, so there's still a difference, actually. Habla. I'm going to have to exaggerate it, because I don't do it natively. Habla, all right, versus habla. In other words, an aspiration represented by the little superscript H versus nothing, all right? But you're right. No, the consequences, both for the marking of pluralization and the marking of the second person singular in the Spanish verb conjugation, this change had enormous structural consequences. And which, again, is a very interesting linguistic point from the point of view of language change, although it has nothing to do with external history, because this is probably all internal. But this is an example of a phonetic process, a s becoming a h, an aspiration process, strictly phonetic, which has very important morpho-syntactic consequences, because it affects both marking of number, singular versus plural, because s is the plural morpheme par excellence in Spanish, and s is also the morpheme that indicates the second person singular in the entire verb system of Spanish. Okay? So you're right. No, but this change, the suta h, is typologically parallel. I mean, the key word here is typologically. All right, it's typologically parallel to the futa h. In other words, s is the sound that's pronounced in the front part of the articulatory apparatus, and the h is pronounced in the back part. So you've got us going from the back to the front. I mean, the other way around, please, the front to the back. The same with the futa h. And the other one in the history of Spanish, and this is something you wouldn't know unless you know the history of the Spanish language, is the jota sound. Like, for example, this word, I'll just take this common word, D-E-J-A-R, which, as you all know who studied Spanish, the common word that means to let, to permit, to allow, dejar, with the h sound. In medieval Spanish, and even early modern, even up to the 17th century, this was spelled like this, E-E-X-A-R, and that X, we know very well, is pronounced as a sh. And in fact, there are varieties of Sephardic Spanish that are still spoken today, although Sephardic Spanish, unfortunately, is dying out rather rapidly. But Sephardic Spanish has retained certain features of the time that the Jews, from the time when the Jews were kicked out of Spain in 1492. And in the varieties of Sephardic Spanish, this is pronounced deshar, with a sh, deshar. So again, we have a sh, front of the mouth, to a k type sound, back of the mouth. All right? Any further questions on that? Or on the whole bit of it. Yeah, I'm sure you did.
Well, two questions now. The first one is, with the deletion of the S, is there an increase in the use of subject pronoun?
Yes, I think so. That's the problem that people have not studied. That's one of those ongoing issues. I think there is. One notices in Caribbean Spanish where this loss of the S is very, very predominant. I mean, it's almost typical. In certain areas, you know, in certain countries, the loss of S is considered to be lower class or regional. For example, in Spain, it's associated with Andalusia, and people in Madrid say, well, those Andalusians, they don't know how to speak Spanish. You know, in fact, one of my colleagues, now retired, who I will not name, objected to our having our junior year abroad program in Seville because this colleague considered the Spanish of Andalusia, where Seville is, to be inferior, to be, you know, not worthy of being studied by foreigners, whereas the speech of Madrid was the model of how you should pronounce it. So in certain countries like Mexico, Spain, there is a regional and social differentiation, whereas in the Caribbean, the loss of S is almost the norm. The lower class uneducated do it, but so do the highly educated upper class do it. In other words, there is no social distinction between the loss. And sometimes, by the way, it's gone all the way. It's in many varieties, it's an aspiration. In other words, a s has become a h. In other words, there still is a sound there. In other words, this form is not homonymous, with this form, because this has this aspiration, this does not. But in other varieties, this H has even gone to the next step, to total elimination, and in which case then, this form, despite the orthographies, are perfectly homonymous. And to distinguish them, yes, there does seem to be a higher frequency of use of the subject pronoun in Caribbean varieties of Spanish. And that, again, could be a change, morphological, again, the consequences of this phonological change. This happened in the history of French. For those of you who know French, as you know, modern French, the use of the subject pronoun is obligatory. You cannot drop the subject pronoun in French. You must use it. In fact, some people argue that in French today, the subject pronoun is really not a subject pronoun, but is actually a prefixed person number marker
that is attached to the verb, because the endings have basically disappeared, although they're there in spelling, they're not there in actual pronunciation. Remember, French spelling is just as bad as English spelling. It's so far out of date, it's pathetic, but it doesn't really reflect the realities of the modern language, okay? Well, the same with the French. But you're right, what was your other question?
Oh, the first time you say son las dos, the S and the las and the dos is almost like a sh sound, like you...
Well, the first time, when I did the Madrid pronunciation, yeah. But that's because the type of S, and this is totally irrelevant to this whole issue, but it's for your own benefit, the S, the phonetic nature of the S of Madrid is very different than the phonetic nature of the S that you hear in southern Spain and in Latin America.
Well, I was just going to say, that S didn't sound too far away from saying the deshar instead of the...
But that's just an acoustic impression. You're quite right, but there's no relationship between the two. No, but the question, your question is legitimate. Okay, listen, I'm going to reward you for your patience. If I start the next topic, I'll never get it finished, and I'd rather not interrupt myself. And it's warm anyway, and so let's give the paper cover a break, too. And so thank you very much, and I'll see you on Thursday.
Before everybody takes off, for the people who spoke in class, we need to have you fill out speaker information forms. It'll just take 2 seconds.
So if you remember what you spoke in class?
Well, I know I wrote down all the people who spoke.
What is this that you want
Lisa to do? Last day of class. You know, earlier will be accepted. Last day of class, which is Tuesday, which is